There are many ways to understand disability culture and what it means to have a disability. In this podcast, for our History of Disability seminar, I'm excited to share with you a conversation with Dr. Steve Brown, Professor Emeritus of University of Hawaii, founder of the Institute on Disability Culture, and one of the founding members of Review of Disability Studies. His research and writing on disability has been a key influence on how we think about a culture of disability. He's also been a key influence on my own thinkings about disability. This has been an extraordinary term that's challenged all of us in ways that none of us could have anticipated. I know from conversations with many of you that this has placed you under extraordinary pressure, personally, professionally, as students, as family members. One of the best things about this course is that it brings together people from such very different disciplines, including social work, in our group, the arts, business, education, health. And I've really enjoyed the ways in which you've been placing our shared dialogue and our shared inquiry here, our look into the history of disability, into dialogue with your own lives as professionals, as students, as husbands, wives, mothers, daughters, sons, with your own experiences of disability, whether with your own body, those close to you. For some of you, I know this has been the first time that you've thought about disability in a different way. And for others, you've long been concerned with disability issues and disability studies. I've been especially impressed that during this challenging time, when sometimes it's been hard to even think clearly, I know many of you have talked about feeling constantly distracted. I know I certainly have. But I've been very impressed that many of you immediately were able to look very clearly at our current situation, this global pandemic, and place it in dialogue with our larger discussion about the history of disability, quickly noting the dangers of discrimination in a climate of fear, and also the ways that this virus, although it certainly impacts the whole world and all of us, that it does not impact everyone equally, and that some of us, for a host of reasons, are more vulnerable than others. And some of you in our rich online discussions have placed this in dialogue with other times in history. Now, our moment's very unique, but you found resonances with other times, whether in Hawaii, with the racially selective containment of those with Hansen's disease, or other times in history, ancient Greece. Part of the reason our historical look at disability has been so important is that it helps shatter some of the power of the myth that disability is solely a medical condition, some kind of unchanging truth about the body. This historical look has helped highlight the ways that how we think about and treat disability is not static and clearly not ahistorical. It shifts and changes as we cross borders and times. And as we've been looking at and considering it, it is always inflected by gender, by class, sexuality, and a host of other individual and collective concerns. And how we define it has been a key part, as we've seen, of how power is distributed. Who gets it? And who gets to say who matters? Our look together through a history of disability has also highlighted for us the power of language in helping to shape how we think about disability. And that, as it's been equally true in many other struggles for rights, feminists, gays, lesbians, and transgendered folks, a key part of their journey has been about reclaiming language and the right to self-define. And so that's been true here too. The words we use matter. And as we've seen in our journey across times and cultures, whether looking at certain cultures and communities, like certain Native American communities, that didn't have a word for disability, and other places in which a body with disabilities was labeled as invalid or unfit, and also how slippery sometimes these labels can be, lumping up the defective, the black body, the woman's body, the disabled body, all as different ways to say who matters. Somehow using words around disability to justify existing systems, hierarchies of power, and the way they distribute or deny power, including withholding property and often, as we've seen, used to justify the reasons why people could not make decisions about their own life. So the words used in culture to talk about disability and the body with disabilities could be used to reinforce existing hierarchies of injustice and distributions of power, or shake those up and help imagine new ways to be together. The Nielsen book in particular has highlighted how we really can't think about colonialism, racism, sexism, or anyism without thinking about disability and ableism. Her argument that in many ways we can see disability at the very heart of the American experience, I think, is very well supported. We've also seen how our expectations of seeing a clear, unbroken narrative of progress in the rights of those with disability and the treatment of people with disabilities was shattered pretty quickly. We see, if anything, a very uneven and up and down road. Prehistoric records showed us that some folks with disabilities appeared to be given perhaps special care and attention. And in contrast, some so-called enlightened times attempted to erase and make invisible the disabled body. We saw in certain post-war times, amputees had higher rates of marriage and less stigma than some experience today. And in ways that took on kind of unexpected resonance for us, certainly did for me, when looking back at it, the ways that disability, infection, and national purity intersect. And the ways that the state has used surveillance and containment of bodies deemed degenerate or seen as threatening or infecting the health of the nation. And policies have been put in place to carefully monitor those entering the U.S. and sterilize deviant bodies already in it. And I'm talking, of course, about earlier times in history, but that perhaps have some relevance for our time, even though we're in a unique moment, that perhaps there are things for us to remain vigilant about. Nielsen points out how sexuality, class, race, gender, ethnicity forcibly intersected with ideas of disability and quality citizenship. Who was a good citizen? We looked at how the nation's industrial education and institutional progress of the progressive era had contradictory consequences for people with disability. This incredible expansion brought incredible wealth and technological advancements that revolutionized adaptive equipment for those with disabilities, but only if they could afford it, and also caused many disabilities, many laborers' bodies placed in danger and under stress. The rise of many of these institutions that purported to care for people with disabilities, in some instances with some disabilities, particularly for the blind and the deaf, institutionalization helped create community and empowerment For other disabilities, particularly those deemed to have mental and cognitive illnesses, disabilities, it led to isolation and frequent abuse. In all of these cases, throughout this look in history, people sought out and created communities, communities that helped them articulate and demand their rights as people and citizens. Your most recent modules celebrated successes for many of these, and we've considered in recent modules some different artistic expressions of people and their experiences of disability. I've been very happy to hear many of you talk about the ways that this journey together has given you some useful stuff picked up along the way to take, to use with your own family, your students, clients, businesses, maybe the ways that we see our own bodies and those close to us. As we start reflecting on our journey so far and look at this spectrum of histories, mistakes, and some forgotten victories that hopefully we've given attention to, and we start thinking about our final projects, it's my great pleasure to share this conversation with Steve Brown. This was done just before the pandemic surprised us all. Steve Brown has had such a profound impact on the ways that we think about disability in this university, in the United States, and internationally. Through his research, his teaching, his writing, his involvement in a host of different projects, including review of disability studies, and his laying out of the Institute on Disability Culture. This two-part conversation, in this first part, we'll talk about kind of the birth of his own disability consciousness and political involvement, and moving towards claiming power and coming to see disability as a source of pride, a site of shared experiences and shared injustices, a culture. He'll talk a bit about his own experiences with discrimination before the ADA, and talks about the importance of history to help us better understand ourselves, to put things in context of the causes and circumstances that have led to the present, and help us develop the power to know and express who we are. My apologies for the technical issues. The sound is not great, and occasionally there are beeps and buzzes that we couldn't remove or clean. Here's Steve Brown. Hi, Steve, Raphael.
Hey, Raphael.
The first thing I wanted to ask you is just if you could say a little bit about how you first came to start studying and thinking about disability and what would lead to thinking about disability culture.
All right, I'd be happy to. So I was teaching these freshman history classes that, you know, were very big. And at the end of one of the first classes in the fall, two students came up to me, introduced themselves. One was blind and one had a visual impairment. And they both said, "You talk really fast. Can you take your lectures?" And I said, "Sure." And I also said, because I was using a cane at that time, I didn't really have a disability consciousness, but I was using a cane, and I said for this discussion, let's say disability. And so we began talking, and eventually, as we continued to talk through the next few weeks, they told me there was this organization in town that had just started called the Independent Living Project, mm-hmm. which for the you who are listening and who understand this, it's what now would be called an independent living center, and those are grassroots disability rights organizations. And the reason it actually wasn't called an independent living center was because the director who had written the grant and who knew about these things refused to call it a center because it was not consumer control. Mm-hmm. Consumer control jargon that means 51% of the board or more, or I mean, and staff, 51% of the board and staff had to be people with disabilities. And the board at that time, which was United Cerebral Palsy of Cleveland County, had, I don't know, let's say 30 members and two had disabilities. So Helen, my mentor in the disability world and still friend and boss, refused to eventually boss. That's where the story's going. Refused to call it a center for that reason. Okay, so in those days, then these two guys invited me to come to a meeting and see if I'd be interested in volunteering for the Independent Living Project. And I hated meetings. My feeling about meetings at that point in my life was people got around, sat around, complained, nothing happened, and then they left. So I went to this meeting because I was still trying to connect with these two students. And lo and behold, they were doing all kinds of things. They were they were planning a statewide independent living conference. They were bringing in a couple of national speakers, names I'd never heard of at that point, but one at least, some people listening may have heard of. One was Frank Bowe, who's no longer with us, but he was a deaf professor, actually, of economics, who was also an advocate, and really nice guy. I became friends with him later on. Mm-hmm. And the other person who you may have heard of was Judy Heumann. And Judy, who's quite well known and who's actually just about this week or next week to come out with a book calling Being Unrepentant, talking about her disability rights life. Mm-hmm. Those two were there. And then the other thing they were doing was they were planning a workshop on sexuality and disability. And so there were all these things going on that I had no clue were actually happening in the world. And I did get interested, and so I did start volunteering. And then the year ended, my job ended, I didn't have any job prospects. I had had one interview, I didn't like them, they didn't like me, that wasn't gonna go anywhere. So I'm sitting at home one day, I had a 4-year-old daughter, married to my ex-wife, and didn't know what I was gonna do and how I was gonna make money, when my department chair called and said there was a company in Tulsa that was looking for somebody to write their history. And would I be interested? And it had nothing to do really with any of my passions, but it had to do with making a living, so yes, I was interested. And I talked to this guy. I'd never written a proposal. Well, it's not quite true, but it's close enough. I'd never written a proposal before, and I especially didn't know how to do budgets. So he really helped me with that. He liked the fact that I had completed my dissertation faster than he completed his. And he should have told me he was a jerk, but instead I was flattered in those days.
This is about 1982, Steve?
Yep, 1982. So, and I know this is a very long way of getting to what you asked me, but it's how I got there.
Oh, great.
So this guy, to show you how long ago this was, this guy was going to travel from Tulsa to Dallas. He was going to stop in Oklahoma City, and we were going to meet for lunch in the airport. You could do that in those days. Security. So anyway, I was really nervous. Before I had gone to meet him, I had told him I was about 6'4", I had a beard, and I had crutches. And as soon as he heard crutches, he asked me what was wrong, and I had no problem talking to him about it, about my disability, which for purposes of this was a mobility disability. Mm-hmm. And we got there, and I was, like I said, I was really nervous. It was a terrible interview, but the way it ended was he was going to call me to come up the next week and sign the contracts. I'd actually already started doing some of the work. They verbally hired me. And then I didn't hear from him. So I called him, and we had a 45-minute conversation, which these are the only two points at this time I remember. One was he told me, maybe if you didn't use crutches, you'd have the ability to write a book. Yeah, and the second one, well, this is Oklahoma, where college football is really big. I was 6'4 and really skinny, like about 160 pounds. And he said, maybe if you had the physique of a football player, you'd have the stamina to do this. But you don't if you don't think you do. So, I slammed down the phone, I drove to the Independent Living Project, started ranting at them, and said, what could I do about it? And they said, we don't think there's anything. And I said, hey, so then I called somebody I knew at a state advocacy office that I'd met in the process, and same thing. Went to a lawyer, same thing. So finally, I ended up going to the Oklahoma Human Rights Commission. They did a report, took about 7 months, and they came back and said, yes, you've been discriminated against. Yes, it's because of a disability, but there's no law against that.
Right.
So there's nothing we can do. So, and I still tell this story for a couple of reasons, one of which is, this is 82, so before ADA, mm-hmm. but even with ADA, the same thing could potentially happen because this was a company that had no federal funding and less than 15 employees. What might be different is lawyers might have a better time in fighting it. So even today, this could still happen. Okay, so the point of all this now and getting to your question is jobs that were funded, one of which was doing what they called skills training, which is kind of assisting somebody with learning how to adapt to a disability.
Uh-huh.
Or, which people probably know what that is, and community organizing. And I was hired for that job. Got to the Independent Living Project, and the first thing I did, because I came from the university, right? So the first thing I did was some research. I went to the local library and looked for books on disability rights. And I found two, both by the same guy, this guy named Frank Bowe. Mm-hmm. Remember Frank? Mm-hmm. So one was called Handicapping America, called Rehabilitating America. And then I was reading things that were coming into the office, like there was this publication that came in called The Disability Rag, mm-hmm. which no longer exists, but it was for those of you who might have seen or maybe even remember Rolling Stone in its early days, it was a newspaper, not the glossy magazine it is today. And anyway, the Rag was kind of modeled like that from a publication layout standpoint. The Rag had a cartoon in it called Disability Rat, and it was about how disability was cool. And sometime in the mid-80s, early 80s, they published this interview with a psychologist named Carol Gill,
mm-hmm.
and he talked about disability culture. And it resonated with me right away. She talked about how most people, when you think about culture, you think about your families, but people with disabilities didn't have that. A different way of getting to culture. And so all of a sudden, I loved pop and popular culture and highbrow culture both. I loved history and reform and fighting injustice.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I went, these things all come together with this concept called disability culture. And that's when I started really paying attention to it.
So all of these aspects kind of came together for you, both your own experience with discrimination, the initial advocacy you did for those students, and your exposure to these publications, Disability Rag, Handicapping America.
Yeah, I wasn't really advocating for the students at that point. They had introduced me to the project.
Okay.
But I had a history of fighting discrimination in various ways before that particular experience. First of all, I'm Jewish, and so I was really aware of how Jews had been treated historically.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, currently then, as well as now, I'd also been one of the people who did things like, when I was a graduate student, we tried to form a student union, and you know, I was involved in that. And so it wasn't that I had no experience with fighting injustice, but it was far more personal with this particular experience of employment discrimination than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And all of this started giving you your own disability consciousness.
Yeah, I mean so the first time I was really aware and publicly demonstrated I had a disability was when I was having a really hard time walking. I used to walk from our house to campus, and it got harder and harder. Mm-hmm. And then it got harder and harder to walk around campus. So sometime in the late 70s, probably, I got my first handicap parking sticker, which is what they called it in those days, or placard. And that was my first public foray into showing that I had a disability. Even, you know, people using crutches, which I had off and on during my life, you know, that could be from lots of different things. So once I got involved in the Independent Living Project, that was a whole new world for me. And I mean, there's lots of things I could talk about with that, but I think it's enough just to say that, yes, I became aware of the world of disability rights at that point. And not just in the U.S., but internationally to some extent as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to what extent you felt that you were also connected to more largely what a lot of students were calling the movement at that time. Mm-hmm. Can you just say a little bit about how those intersected, like this disability consciousness and ideas about the movement?
Are you talking about other rights?
Yeah, other rights movements and just kind of the campus happenings around identifying with the countercultural movement.
Okay. Well, sure. So one thing I didn't say was I was also a Vietnam War protester in my early college days. Hmm. And so I was really aware. I was aware. I started college in 1969.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting time. because in 1970, there was the first, I believe it was then, that there was the first Earth Day. So the environment was, people were becoming more aware of. Of course, there was protests about the war. And in my case, actually, that's kind of relevant to what we're talking about, because I was involved in the protests, and I did go to D.C. actually for one of the protests. But I got pretty disgusted with it because a lot of people were there to party. Some people were there to actually make change. And then there were people who were talking about peace, but they were doing it in a way that included violence, which really disgusted me.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know at that point, this is 69, 70, 71, what major I was going to have. I was at a university where I could go for 2 years without choosing one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what actually led me to become a historian, because I wanted to learn how to do revolution right. So, and that's accurate. That is what I wanted. And so I was aware of those kinds of things. I was aware of the women's movement. I was aware of the civil rights movement. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, it was a very emotional reaction that I had, and I really started writing at that time with an unconscious awareness that writing was something I wanted to do as part of my life, if not all of it. So I'm sure I'm forgetting other things too, but all of those things came together. So I was aware that disability rights fit into human rights, and these days I would even go beyond that and say other kinds of rights too. But I was really conscious of that.
Now, one of the wonderful things about this course, or both courses, Disability History Across the Ages and From Homer to Hip Hop, is they bring together such a wide group of students, some who are well-versed in disability studies. And for a lot of the students, this course is their first introduction to disability studies, and even to thinking about disability in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So with
mm-hmm.
that in mind, keeping in mind all of these folks, just getting some basic things on the table, how would we define disability culture for someone who's never heard the term before?
This is what I still use, and it's on our website. People with disabilities have forged a group identity. We share a common history of oppression, and a common bond of resilience. We generate art, music, literature, and other expressions of our lives and our culture infused from our experience of disability. Most importantly, we are proud of ourselves as people with disabilities. We claim our disability with pride as part of our identity. We are who we are. We are people with disabilities. And that last sentence probably wouldn't be needed anymore, but in those, when I wrote this, which I first wrote it in 1996, people didn't necessarily look at us as being who we were. So it was really important. And in fact, the article that originally came from was actually all about power and reclaiming or claiming, really, our power.
And I know that in your path you've felt that understanding and learning history has been a key part of empowering people. And for these courses, why do you feel that an understanding of kind of broad human history related to disability is so important, beyond just immediate history of the struggle for rights? Why do you think this broader history of understanding humans' relationship with disability through history and prehistory is so important?
Right. Well, I guess I'd say two reasons come off the top of my head. One is I think history, period, is important. Not a surprise, since I'm a historian by training.
Yeah.
And that's because how do we know who we are if we don't know who we've been? What came to create the group of people that we are today? You know, we didn't just, you know, none of us were just born into a family or a culture or whatever it is that we were born into that was a blank slate. All of our cultures and societies and families have developed the way they have for a reason. And what happened historically is a part of that reason. So that's one reason. The other reason is if we don't know who we are, no matter what it is, you know, if you're disabled, if you're Hawaiian, whatever it is, if you don't know who you are, how can you expect other people to know that?
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering a little bit about, you know, of course, a lot of cultures have consider themselves to have kind of non-permeable boundaries. You know, there are people in that culture and people outside of that culture, and disability is very different than that. In general,
I'm sorry. What way? How different? How is that different?
Well, that people who at one time in their life might not identify as disabled through different circumstances at another time in their life might.
Okay.
Where with some identities, of course, like certain ethnic identities, that's unlikely to happen, although it may.
Right. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Anyways, I'm kind of wondering, you know, different disability activists sometime invite everyone, all humans, to feel that in certain ways they are part of, very real part of the experience of disability.
Mm-hmm.
That it
mm-hmm.
is in no ways a special interest group, that it is you know, maybe could be considered just essential what it is to have a human body.
Right.
I'm just wondering your thoughts on the lines of inclusiveness and the lines of membership into thinking about disability culture.
Okay, well, when I wrote the definition, I talked about people with disabilities talking about our lives.
Yeah.
And I did that for a reason. And as I said, the article came from was about power. So a simple maybe a analogy is you probably don't want a, let's say, a battered women's shelter.
Mm-hmm.
You probably want that to be run by men.
Yeah.
In the same way, in the earlier days especially, disability organizations, not necessarily disability rights organizations, because there weren't a whole lot of those, but disability organizations were run by people who didn't have the personal experience of disability themselves. Sometimes they were professionals and sometimes they were parents and they had those experiences, but they didn't have the actual having a disability itself experience frequently.
Mm-hmm.
So and this actually fits really nicely with your I think previous question about why history is important, because now, if you're looking at disability rights organizations in the 1940s and 50s, they're very different today. If you go back to the, let's say, the 1960s and 70s, but especially the 70s, Ed Roberts, who I don't know if you've talked about any of the mm-hmm. classes, but he was a person who had had polio, was in California. He became a quadriplegic, could only move a couple fingers on his left hand and a couple toes on his left foot, used a ventilator and an iron lung at night, and he became in 1962 the first person with that kind of ability to become a student at the University of California at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
St. James Meredith became the first black student at the University of Mississippi. And he lived in the hospital on campus, the student health center. And the reason he lived there was none of the dorms could accommodate his iron lung.
Mm-hmm.
So a few years prior to that, the University of Illinois, first in Galesburg, Illinois, a tiny little town, and then in Champaign, began to have students with disabilities, primarily veterans at first, but then others, coming onto their campus. I mentioned my own experience of the independent living project I worked at in the early 1980s, where the board was primarily non-disabled people. So if you look at it that way, in those days especially, there was a need not only to have people with disabilities involved in their own lives, in making our own decisions, but also in running our own organizations.
Mm-hmm.
That may or may not be as important today, depending on where you are. And that's kind of why, I said this is historically important, because it could be just as important somewhere, and it could be less important. I know there are people who don't have disabilities who are in some way involved in creating disability culture, but that's not where my focus is on people with disabilities who are creating it.
That was our conversation with Steve Brown. We'll pick up next week with the second half of this podcast, where he'll talk a bit about his role in the formation of the Review of Disability Studies, some of his other work, and what he's most excited about today. Bye for now.